You know that feeling when your day finally slows down and you just want to relax, unplug, and feel good? That's where Mood.com comes in. They're changing the game, delivering legal THC products right to your door, no shady dealers, and absolutely no medical card required, just good vibes and better sleep, shipped straight from their farm to your couch. From delicious THC gummies, smooth vape pens, to premium THC flower, Mood has it all. And everything's federally legal under the 2018 Farm Bill. Yeah, this isn't some loophole. It's the real deal. Head to Mood.com and use code FIRST20 for 20% off your first order. That's MOOD.com. Find your mood.
I'm Kathy with a C, and this is Kathy with a K. And she will be doing today's destination, despite the fact that her voice sounds like crap. Here you go, friend.
Today's destination is Alpharetta, Georgia. The history of Alpharetta dates back to the 1830s, when settlers and pioneers traveled to the area seeking the promise of community in land ownership, raising families, and fertile farmland. From its humble beginnings as a trading post, the community found prosperity, and the city of Alpharetta was established on December 11, 1858. Alpharetta has known its challenges, from the 1863 smallpox epidemic to the ravages of the Civil War, but always found a way to persevere. The city remained a small, largely agrarian community through the early 1980s, but shortly thereafter, the city blossomed into one of the most prosperous communities in the United States. The community that had a population of only 3,000 in 1980 is now home to more than 65,000 residents and sees its population swell to more than 100,000 each workday. Alpharetta is now Georgia's 12th most populous city, boasts some of the best schools in the United States, and is known far and wide as the technology city of the South due to the large number of tech-focused companies that call Alpharetta home. But in 2018, the community's shine faded when one of its prominent citizens met a gruesome fate by a wolf in sheep's clothing.
On Thursday, July 5th, 2018, Melody Ferris sounded the alarm with her children. She told them, "I haven't seen your dad in 2 days." Now at 6'4" and 320 pounds, Gary Ferris, Melody's husband, was affectionately called Big Daddy.
Only by his family that we can tell. We're not sure if that extends, because Southerners have nicknames.
I know.
And so other people could have called him that too, but we're hoping it's just his family.
So Gary was the glue of his family, and his kids were shocked. He and Melody met each other at the University of Alabama. They were both 58 years old at this time and had been married for 38 years. So they got married when they were babies. They
absolutely
were just 20 years old. They had 4 children, 2 boys and 2 girls, and they're all adults at this point in their 20s and 30s, and they also have grandchildren from 2 of their children. And the Ferris family home was the central gathering place, and it really reflected the affluence that the family had built. Gary was an attorney. He was a commercial real estate attorney, and he was a partner in a firm in Atlanta.
And very prominent in Atlanta and Georgia for his skills as an attorney.
So their home was a beautiful 10-acre property in Alpharetta, and it had on it a custom-built, stunning home of, what, 8,000 square feet?
More than 8,000 square feet.
Yes, it was beautiful.
And we're not quite sure of the bedrooms, because we looked at 3 different real estate sites, and they all gave us different information. So it's anywhere from 4 to 8 bedrooms and 3 to 6 bathrooms.
Yeah, Kathy and I totally went down a Zillow Vortex.
And Redfin.
I was like,
Realtor.
I could live here. It was so beautiful.
Kathy
so beautiful.
Was going to make an offer if it was up for sale.
Exactly. It also had a barn on the property with living quarters. And I think the barn was about 300 yards from the house.
Yeah, about
so
that.
It was kind of this, you know, this nice, I'm not going to say isolated, but you felt like you had your own space. And they had a son there, Scott, living above the barn in the living quarters. And again, beautiful property. Scott was a vet. I think he was in his late 20s or maybe...
I think he was late 20s or 30. He was also going to be a big daddy one day because, unlike his father, at puny 6'4", Scott clocked in at 6'8".
Yeah, 6'8".
And 280 pounds.
So honestly, 280 is like he was probably a very fit guy.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, if he's 6'8" and 280. Anyway, so on this Thursday, Melody told her kids that she had last seen her husband on Tuesday at dinner time. And now this was July 3rd. And I guess Gary had asked her, what's for dinner?
Yes, he had. And she said something along the lines of, get it yourself. There's enough food in here to feed Cox's army. So, of course, I had to look up to see what that meant, not being Southern and all. I didn't know if it was a Southern term or something, which it might be. I'm still not sure. But she got it wrong. It was actually Cox's army. And it was a Confederate general who, it was some comment. Clearly, I researched it well. It was some comment in regards to his troops.
Yeah.
So it was basically her way. It was the nice Southern way of saying bless your heart, which was basically
bless
F
your heart
off and get it yourself.
Make your own dinner.
Exactly.
Yeah. So Gary had to make his own dinner on July 3rd, Tuesday. Anyway, so on July 3rd, Gary had taken work off. My assumption is that they had it off for Independence Day, but I don't know. He was a partner. He could do what he wants. And he stayed home on the farm that day and he just worked the land. He did what he loved doing. He putzed around and he just, you know, he did his farm stuff.
Cut the grass.
Exactly. Fed goats, whatnot. The next day, Independence Day, Melody and some of her family members went to Lake Lanier and Gary didn't go. Melody wasn't concerned when she didn't see Gary on the 4th of July because she knew that he didn't want to go to the lake. So here we are on Thursday and she's explaining to her kids that she has not seen him. And what happened was on the 4th of July, she brought a couple of her grandkids home to spend the night and they wanted to go on the, what is it called?
RTV.
RTV, the
rough terrain vehicle.
Rough terrain vehicle, which to me just looks like a souped up golf cart.
See, I don't see it as a souped up golf cart. I see it as like a souped down golf cart.
Oh no, it has like big wheels and.
Yeah, but it's all like metal. It's not like all shiny and like sports car like. It's more like out in the fields kind of thing.
Yeah, no, like.
It's more rudimentary in my mind.
Those are fun to be in. I've been in them before, but it is like you just feel like you're speeding around in a golf cart, but that's just me. Anyway, so the kids wanted to play on the RTV. And so Melody said, go get Big Daddy and, you know, he'll go on a ride with you. And they came back and they said, we don't know where he is. So Melody then starts looking, looks through the house, doesn't see him. She is now concerned and calls her kids. Three of her children help her look. Scott, who lives on the property, his brother and one of his sisters shows up to look for Dad. Now, they're very concerned because Gary is a large man and he smoked too much and he had high blood pressure. So they were very afraid that he was laying in some field having had a stroke or a heart attack or whatever. So they all spread out and they start searching. Scott goes to the deer camera.
I'm going to explain the deer camera.
Okay.
So a deer camera is put usually in a copse of trees where you have wildlife and it's mounted so that it's motion sensored and anybody or any animal that goes by it, it will record the animal as it's there. And the reason I know is because I lived in Maine for a very short amount of time, but still.
Everyone's probably like, a deer camera is self-explanatory. Thank you very much.
No, but it's not because you don't know that it's in a copse of trees. You don't know that it's motion sensored. You don't know why they would have it. They
exactly.
didn't have any deer that we saw.
Right. So Scott goes to the deer camera and he sees that there are 7 photographs that it has taken. So he looks through the photos. He sees none of them are of any consequence. One, I think, was his sister walking by.
It was a female, but I don't know if it was a sister.
Well, we hope so. So he deletes the photos and continues on. Remember, we're on Thursday. Scott was gone all day on July 4th, the day prior. But on July 3rd, when his dad was home and working the land, like he chatted with his dad, Scott remembered that his father said that he needed to light the burn pile. And so they had a burn pile on their property that was about, I think, 100 yards or so from the house. And it was about 15 feet in diameter.
Which is huge.
The large space. Anyway, Scott, his dad, his mom, they would put various articles of debris or branches or whatever in the burn pile. They would let it pile up and they would torch it, which, of course, is a very common practice. I say, of course, as though I know.
When was the last time you lit one?
Actually, I had a neighbor who lived next to me like 15 years ago, and that's what he did. He burned his trash.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I would see like through the fence, I would see this major bonfire, and I'm like, okay, get your hose ready just in case. And the irony is, it was an older man who was living in the home of a firefighter. But so anyway, Scott remembered that on Tuesday, his dad said that he wanted to light up the burn pile. And he had been saying it over the course of a couple days. I've got to light the fire. I've got to take care of that debris. Well, on Tuesday night, Scott got home late at night. And he looks out the window from his apartment and he sees a glow, but it doesn't concern him because he knows it's the burn pile and he figures that his dad has finally gotten around to torching it. So here we are on Thursday. He decides he's going to go to the burn pile and he's going to look and make sure his dad's not there.
Right. Like he didn't have a heart attack and fall or exactly. Something like that.
So he goes to the burn pile and he's relieved to see that his dad is not laying anywhere nearby.
Right.
And he's kind of thinking about what to do next. And then he glances down and he sees something that makes him pause. So he looks again and then calls 911. What he believed he saw were bones. Police arrived to find Melody crying and her three adult children highly concerned. But the police are looking at the scene and they're thinking maybe he had a heart attack, maybe something happened and he fell in. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. We're not even sure these are human bones. Detectives who came to the scene said, okay, we're going to sift through this because at this point, there's now about 5 inches of ash in the burn pit. We're going to sift through them. We're going to take out things that are important, but we need an anthropologist to come to the scene. So they call an anthropologist. They also bring in crime scene techs. The anthropologist arrived on the scene in the late afternoon. Now, this is Thursday again, and it's after 3 o'clock, and everybody is on pins and needles, and the crime scene techs are running around the property doing their thing. And the anthropologist confirms that they are human bones. So now they know they have to test them to see if they belong to Gary. But police, of course, are very concerned. So they continue treating the entire property as though it may be a crime scene. As they're sifting through the bones, they find one, specifically a rib bone, that has a .38 caliber bullet lodged in it. They now know it's not a heart attack. It's not an accident. Whoever was in the burn pit was murdered. It took 3 weeks, but eventually it was determined that, in fact, this was Gary Ferris's remains. So while at the property, crime scene techs knew they needed to, you know, collect DNA samples to create a profile on Gary.
Right. Even before they knew that it was murder. But once they found the bullet, of course, that ramped everything up.
Exactly. So they collected items that they knew would contain his DNA. They also took photographs of the interior of the house, the exterior of the house. They took photographs of the RTV and the tractor. They took photographs of the barn and the burn pit. And they seized guns that they found in the house, and they seized ammunition that they found in the barn. What they did, because the only people living at the property at this point now are Melody and Scott. And they said, can we swab your hands? And they were swabbing for accelerants and probably gunshot residue.
Right.
Both of them said, of course you can.
Right.
And came back clean. While at the scene, two critical pieces of evidence were collected and photographed. The first were drops of blood. And the second was a .38 caliber bullet that was on the floor in Gary's basement.
And it was a spent bullet.
Correct. So as for the drops of blood, there were 4 tiny drops of blood on the kitchen floor, sort of spaced in an arc as though somebody were walking and bleeding. And then they took the stairs down to the basement, and the basement stairs were carpeted. So there are tiny droplets of blood on a couple of these stairs. We are not talking about a lot of blood.
And not only that, but we're also not talking about, you know, if you're walking and bleeding, how it leads kind of spatter behind it.
Yeah.
This had none. It was like it was drop, drop, drop.
Yeah. And it wasn't even as large as what you would consider a traditional drop.
It was less than a quarter of an inch.
It was tiny. Anyway, there were no smears. They were just droplets, these teeny little droplets leading down to the basement.
And actually continued into the basement. There were a couple of drops of blood on the hardwood floor there as well. Police theorized that Gary had been shot in the kitchen had then gone down into the basement where he stayed, and that's also where they found additional blood. So Gary and Melody did not stay in the same bedroom. They lived in the same house, but he lived on what they called the basement level, but what real estate sites called the terrace level.
The terrace, yes. This was not like a serial killer basement.
Exactly.
You know, if I had a basement in my house, it would be dank, dark, serial killer-ish.
Exactly.
Not this place. This was like a standalone, nicely appointed little home.
And that's where Gary slept. The reason that Gary lived in the basement or the terrace level is that he slept with a CPAP machine. And Melody wanted absolutely nothing to do with it being upstairs in the bedroom because it was loud and it kept her awake.
So everyone said that Melody basically had control of the upper two floors and Gary just lived on the bottom in the terrace.
Which is where they had a well-appointed kitchen and they had a theater room. And so I would have stayed down there too.
Oh, it was so beautiful.
Yeah.
So can I tell an inappropriate CPAP story?
Always. Well, okay, not even CPAP. You can always tell an inappropriate story.
So we went camping.
Oh, I know this story.
Exactly. This is like 20 years ago, at least. And we went camping and we were all in tents. So it was Kathy's sister and brother-in-law and their kids. And so I think I had four at the time. Anyway, so we're all tent camping. And in the middle of the night, I am jarred awake by this noise. And it's like this. And I thought there was a bear.
I was like, good reason. We were in bear territory.
Oh, we were totally in bear territory. Yeah. So I think there's a bear and I am like frozen stiff. I'm terrified. And I'm also thinking, what's going to happen? How do I do this? And I'm thinking, I don't have any weapons, blah, 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 blah. All these things are going through my head. Meanwhile, I realize like, this is too rhythmic. This is not a bear. And I'm like, oh my God, my poor best friend's husband is snoring like that. This is crazy. So we have this conversation the next day. I'm like, oh my God, I heard him snoring. That's insane. She's like, this is how I live, blah, 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 blah. So fast forward, I have to go to an ENT. And so the ENT is whatever, talking to me about whatever I'm there for. And I see this advertisement and it was for like sleep apnea. And so I go, oh my gosh, I said, this is, you know, what is this treatment for sleep apnea? And he goes, why? Does your husband snore? I go, oh no, but oh my God, my best friend's husband snores so loud. It is unbelievable. You cannot believe how bad it is. And I'm telling him.
I never get any sleep when he's there.
He totally had this look on his face like, oh, okay. But I wasn't understanding it. I thought the look was, he understands how bad the snoring is or whatever. Anyway, so I was like, it's kind of a weird look, but whatever. So I was like, tell me about this procedure. And he goes, well, why don't you have your best friend's husband call me? And I was like, okay, okay. So I'm walking out to the parking lot to my car. I was like, why was he looking at me funny? And all of a sudden I was like, oh my God. When he was like, is it your husband? Oh no, it's my best friend's husband. His eyes were like, boing. Anyway, so that's my CPAP story. Yes. Oh my God.
Funny.
Okay. So anyway, so back to the dynamic between Melody and Gary. So they did live separately and they also didn't keep track of each other. And of course, Gary is a very busy partner in a law firm. So he's, you know, all over the place all of the time. And so it wasn't unusual if they hadn't seen each other for a day, day and a half, but they were concerned at this point.
As the crime scene techs are searching the basement, they see the blood, of course. They also find this spent .38 caliber cartridge on the floor as well.
And it wasn't covered in blood. You know, the photographs
that we could see. And there was DNA found on it, but it was never specified what kind of DNA.
Right. And so one of the things that Scott tells one of the detectives while they're at the scene is like, oh, by the way, there used to be a pistol in my dad's basement, but it's not here. We don't know where it went. He also told the detective, and you know what I thought was odd? My mother had my father's wallet. And I guess he asked her like, Mom, why do you have dad's wallet? And she said, oh, he left it in the center console of his car.
And Scott's reply was, that was crazy. My dad would never leave his wallet in his car. To which Kathy and I then had a kind of a conversation because I said, I totally get that. I never would leave my wallet. But Kathy was like, I would totally leave my wallet in the car by accident.
I do. For those of you who know me, come get my wallet.
If you know where she lives, it's there every night.
But I do sometimes leave my wallet in the car. Center console. It's safe. So another statement that Scott makes to the detective is kind of chilling. He said, I always thought that if anything happened to my dad, my mom would need to be checked out. Can you imagine?
I can't imagine thinking it about someone, especially right. your mom.
Oh my God, exactly. So, of course, he has the interest of the detectives at the scene. And at some point within the following week, they interview all the family members.
Right.
And they, what was the term?
Well, in talking to some other folks around town and those who knew the Ferrises, they learned that the Ferrises were called the Ferris wheel because they were always spinning in circles. There was always drama, usually kind of whipped up by Mom Melody, but the drama was nonstop. And so it was spinning, spinning, spinning. You couldn't get off the ride. You were stuck on it as it was. And you made a couple of comments about the family as well.
It reminded me of the kind of family where, you know, it's not the kids against the children. Like, to me, that's a very healthy thing.
You just said the kids against the children.
Oh. I meant the kids against the parents, right. You know? Adversity unites. Like, parents have to stay together. Kids have to stay together. Yeah. Kids versus the parents all day long. And you're hoping that, you know, the battles aren't too significant.
Right.
But in this family, it seemed to me, just based on everything I read, I mean, there were a million reports in the newspapers.
And text messages and whatnot.
Yeah, there were a lot of text messages that were displayed during court TV. But it seemed that there were a lot of communications between the parents, between Gary and Melody, but particularly Melody, and their children about their siblings. And so it didn't strike me that there was this unified, cohesive, this is your sister, you're supposed to protect her, this is your brother, you always defend him, da da da. There wasn't that rah, rah, rah family thing. It was more like, did you know that dad paid for this for your brother and he didn't pay for this for you? So it just seemed like there was a lot of division created.
They were trying to intentionally drive wedges between the children. It was a divide and conquer strategy because if the four of them weren't united, they weren't stronger than the parents.
Yeah.
Especially the mom. Dad probably did too, but I didn't see the text messages for that. But the mom, she was pitting child against child against child.
Yeah. Melody was really, really big into texting and not a lot of it was positive.
And it all revolved around money.
So when police were interviewing the family, and really in particular Melody, they realized that Gary and Melody had a fraught relationship. And Melody told detectives that Scott and Gary had a difficult relationship and they were arguing about Scott having to leave the property at some point and, you know, get a job, even though he was working his butt off at the farm. Melody told police officers that this was an issue between Gary and Scott. Melody also admitted that she and her husband fought over finances. She said she was unhappy that she didn't have her own debit card, but she did say that she had Gary's debit card that, you know, she had access to and could use and all this kind of stuff. So the police know that not everything is hunky-dory in paradise. And they ask Melody, do you think your husband was having an affair? And she says, no. And then they ask, were you having an affair? And she says, no. She later clarified that I had an affair, but it ended a year ago. So what happens is when Melanie denies having an affair at the time of her husband's murder, the police know in a very short amount of time that she was lying.
So what happened is when police were searching her house, they actually found, or I guess not her house, it was their house at the time, but they saw her purse. And so they looked through it. And inside of the purse, they found normal things, credit cards, whatnot. They found birth control pills, which she was 58 years old. So that was a little odd. Maybe she was holding them for a friend. But I don't know. Why else would she have them? But they also found a credit card that did not have her name on it. It did not have her husband's name on it. It had the name of Roy Barton. So they need to find out who this Roy is. And it turned out that starting about 4 years prior, Melody had spent a lot of time in Tennessee looking after her cousin. So really quickly, Kathy and I went to a convention. It's been a long time now. Has it been, 2023, March 2023?
I think it was
2023. We went to the Literary Ink Tattoo Convention. Shout out to Jennifer Edge.
Hi, Jennifer and Jessica.
And everybody was talking about, well, I'm just going to go to Birmingham. Well, I'm just going to go to Athens. And we're like, you're in Chattanooga. Like, how are you going there? And so we learned that there's a triangle there. And it's easy enough access to all of those places that it's just kind of like one big metropolitan area. I mean, everyone knows we live in Southern California. And if you didn't, you know now. It's just long.
Everything's spread out. Everything takes a long time to get to. That's just because of our traffic.
So to think that three states have this metropolitan area was a little weird for us.
Right.
But speaking of which, do you also remember what happened in Chattanooga?
What part? Okay. There was a lot that happened in Chattanooga.
So on one of the days, Kathy and I had some time to ourselves.
Oh, I remember this.
And so we decide to go out and
let's just drive around and see what Chattanooga's like.
Exactly. Yeah. We go outside of Chattanooga. We just kind of want to see what's there. And as we're driving down some residential streets, Kathy was driving. Well, you were driving, right?
I think so.
And so we drive by and I was like, oh my God, that's the biggest squirrel in the whole entire world. Like, it was the biggest squirrel. And I'm like, you got to turn around. You got to see this squirrel.
Yeah. We were like, oh my God, that's huge.
Like,
yeah.
They grow squirrels this
big. Make a U-turn. We wanted to take a picture of it.
Exactly. Because that's how we go. And then we wanted to pet it. I'm just kidding.
No.
Just kidding. But anyway, so we drive by, we see the squirrel, and Kathy's like, holy cow, like that is the biggest squirrel in the world.
Yeah.
And so we do a third pass, and we're like, that's not a squirrel.
That can't be a squirrel.
The tail was wrong.
I was like, it looks like a beaver.
Exactly. Yeah. Like it was a combination squirrel beaver. So of course we go to Google and we're like, what large squirrel-like animal lives in Chattanooga, Tennessee?
Lives in the ground in Chattanooga.
Right. Yeah, yeah, lives in the ground. Because we saw it going into the ground. It wasn't running up to the tree. And so we found out it was a, what kind of wood would a woodchuck chuck if a woodchuck could chuck wood?
Exactly.
So it was a woodchuck, which you've like, never seen.
I've never seen a woodchuck.
So if you ever are in Tennessee and see a really big squirrel, it's a woodchuck.
It's a woodchuck.
And the more you know.
The more you know. Everyone's like, you guys are idiots.
Exactly. You need to get out more.
Yeah, we don't see woodchucks where we live.
Exactly. So, or on any of our travels. And we were in Bulgaria and we didn't see woodchucks.
Yeah, no woodchucks in Bulgaria.
Come back at that.
Exactly. So back to the story.
Yes.
Okay, so Roy Barton, this gentleman whose name is on this credit card, they quickly look him up. Detectives are like, who is this guy? So it's a salesman from Tennessee. I think, what kind of cells did he do? What kind of cells? Was it?
Farm equipment.
Okay, farm equipment.
And he didn't go by Roy. He went by Rusty.
So police reach out to Rusty and they have a conversation. Why does the incomparable Melody have your credit card in her purse? All of it comes out. They've been having an affair for 4 years, as Kathy said. Did you say how they met?
No. Okay. So Melody had been spending a lot of time in Tennessee because she was taking care of her cousin, who was actually a couple of decades, I think, older than she was.
Wow.
So she was an elderly woman.
Do you think she was? You know what? She probably was.
Anyway, so as we said, Melody was visiting her cousin Martha in Tennessee to take care of her. And Martha's stepson dropped by. And he was none other than the incomparable, as you described Melody, Rusty Barton.
They were not biological relatives, just for the record.
Well, yeah, it was his stepmother.
Okay.
So because Rusty lived in Tennessee and Melody had to go take care of Martha, she was able to go back and forth between Alpharetta and Tennessee without raising any eyebrows from her husband.
Exactly. And so they began an affair in 2014, and here we are in 2018. And it turns out that the family was aware of Rusty.
Because Melody was inappropriate. And apparently her husband knew, and I don't know how long he had known, but in 2016, her second oldest child, but her oldest daughter, Emily, got married. And Melody invited none other than Rusty to the wedding. And everybody there knew that that was her boyfriend.
Bad form on Melody's part, inviting the boyfriend
on Kathy's part
to her daughter's wedding. But we did find out that prior to that, I guess Gary and Melody had spoken about divorce and decided, no, we're not going to get divorced. We're going to stick this out.
It was actually 7 years prior to the wedding. In 2009, Melody had been caught cheating by Gary.
Separately, different guy.
And Gary caught her, tried to serve her with divorce papers. And her son, Chris, told a story in court under oath. He testified to the fact that one day he had been doing sales in the area and he went to the family home to use the bathroom. And he got to the porch and there was a process server on the porch trying to serve his mother. So he called his dad and said, Dad, what's going on? There's a process server here. And the dad said, oh, I'm trying to serve her with divorce papers. Apparently, Melody refused to come out of her bedroom, so she could never be served.
So they stayed married, but Rusty was sort of an open secret, shall we say?
Yes.
So now police are obviously looking very, very hard at Melody. And the first interview they had when they pulled Rusty in was on July 10th.
So this was just a little under a week after they found Gary's body.
And I'm sure they're getting the lay of the land. It was the Georgia Bureau of Investigation and the Cherokee County Sheriffs that were doing the interviewing. So then they pull him back in 2 weeks later. And at this point, I think it was just the Georgia Bureau of Investigation.
Oh, okay.
So on July 24th, so this is 20 days, like 19 days after they realize that Gary has been murdered, he tells them in the last minute of the last conversation we had, Melody told me Gary is in the burn pile. No. Wait a second. What she said was he is in the burn pile. To which he responds, what? And then Melody says, he's in the burn pile. And then Rusty tells her, do not say another word. Do not tell me anything. I do not need to know. So investigators are like, oh my God, that's practically an admission of murder.
Right.
We got her. So they get the phone records and they see that at 2:20 in the morning on
July 4th.
Okay. So this is literally in the early morning hours, okay? So they're thinking that, okay, this makes sense in the chronology. They believed that Gary was in the burn pile on July 3rd, which was Tuesday, because remember Scott said when he came home late that night, he saw the glow of the fire. So this phone call between Melody and Rusty occurred about 4 hours after Scott saw the glow of the fire. So now they have this conversation from Melody, told to them by somebody she loves. So of course they're like, okay, she's it. She's our only suspect, but we have to wait for the DNA to come in and we have to wait for the digital evidence to come in. And that took nearly a year to have everything neatly tied up in a bow. So on June 18th of 2019, almost a year after Gary's remains were discovered, Melody was arrested. And she was arrested in Tennessee, right?
She was arrested in Tennessee. She was in a car being driven by Rusty.
And she had placed her house on the market.
Yeah.
According to the real estate sites that Kathy and I stalked earlier. So Melody was charged with malice murder, which is their version of murder one, premeditated killing. Aggravated assault, and that was for the fact that she was alleged to have shot her husband first, lying to law enforcement in the course of an investigation, and concealment of a body. She's charged with these four counts. She, at some point, gets bail set at $250,000. She served some time in the pokey.
Yeah, before somebody got the cash together.
Exactly.
Trial began in October of 2024. This is just almost 6.5 years after Gary Ferris was killed. It's no surprise, based on everything we've talked about, the theme surrounding the prosecution was
Melody's desire to have a new and different life with Rusty.
And you know what I don't think we mentioned is that Melody actually had a $2 million life insurance policy. And I don't know if it was her policy or his, but she was the beneficiary of $2 million if Gary were to die.
The only place I saw that was the Atlanta Constitution.
But it's the Atlanta Constitution. So I feel secure in reporting it, repeating it.
Repeating it.
Exactly.
We are not reporters. So during the trial, it was important for the prosecution to communicate to the jury what the vibe was like in the household, how people were treated, the relationships and all that kind of stuff. So three of Melody's children, Scott, Chris, and Emily, all took the stand.
And they were also the three oldest.
For the prosecution. And they basically painted a picture of a woman who was a divider. Someone who was critical of Gary, and they all love Gary.
And critical of her kids.
And critical, but...
to each other.
Yes, to each other. So she just was a divider.
Like, well, and honestly, the one child who didn't take the stand against her was Amanda, who was the youngest. And it's just based on text messages we saw. So it's not indicative of all of the text messages, but just based on those, she was sending a lot of text messages to Amanda saying, Chris just got this paid for, and Emily just got this paid for, and Scott just got this paid for.
But Big Daddy wouldn't pay for this for you.
Right, exactly.
You know, that kind of thing. So the three older ones painted a picture of a mother just like that. And Scott talked about how it was Monday, July 2nd. He heard his mother. She was so angry. And she said, I cannot wait till your father is dead. I cannot wait till I don't have to see his face anymore. They had gotten in a big fight where she had thrown a plate against,
the front of the house.
Yeah, like against the front door. Gary took a videotape of it. Says, like, this
showing the shattered parts of the plate.
Exactly, saying this is what happens when you leave a plate out or something like that. This was the same night that he asked what's for dinner.
No, it was the night before.
Oh,
it was the night before, which my theory is he was just twisting that knife.
Yeah.
Knew it would piss her off and decided to do it anyway.
Yeah. So she had thrown the plate on Monday. And then on Tuesday night, he supposedly said what's for dinner.
Exactly.
But also Melody's phone showed pictures of her with cut fingers on the night she threw the plate. So,
which also we thought could have been the sources of blood that they found, but that was all found to be Gary's DNA.
Exactly. So Scott painted a picture, because he lived on his parents' property, of somebody having his finger on the pulse of his parents' relationship. And Chris, I think, was the oldest.
He was.
So he also provided a lot of detail and background and talked about the fact that they were going to get divorced and then they decided not to. And, you know, so there was a lot. There was a lot of family strife. Amanda took the stand for the defense. And again, she was the youngest, as Kath said. And her testimony made me so sad, because basically she said, my mom told me she didn't do this. And until it's proven otherwise, I'm going to believe my mom. You know, my dad's dead. He's never coming back. And I can't imagine my mom spending the rest of her life in prison. Like, basically, both parents gone like that. Anyway, so Rusty also took the stand. Rusty was going to be a prosecution witness originally, and the prosecutors wanted him on the stand to say, isn't it true that 20 days after the murder, you told us that Melody admitted to you that Gary was on the burn pile?
Before his body was found.
Exactly. And so that's what the prosecutor wanted the jury to hear. That was kind of like what really solidified Melody as the prime suspect.
Right.
But what happened was, a day after Melody was arrested, because remember, Melody was arrested in Rusty's car, he was traumatized by the fact that the lady he's in love with for 4 years is arrested.
His lady friend.
Exactly. And she was arrested just about a year after the murder. So the next day, he goes in with an attorney to the sheriff's office and recants his statements. He said, about a year ago, you guys asked me this question about, you know, Melody making these statements. I told you when she made them. I think I was wrong. I'm not sure what phone call she said this, you know, and so he backtracked on what he said. And the reality is, they had a lot of conversations, but the most critical conversation was the one that happened at about 2:20 in the morning. So the early morning hours of July 4th. About 4 hours after Scott saw the burn pile fire. Okay.
But about a day, well, more than a day before Gary's body was found.
Exactly. And so the detectives were like, this is the conversation. This is the critical conversation. This is what we got to get this guy to say on the stand.
Slam the cell door shut.
Exactly. So anyway, Rusty takes the stand and he seems like a gentleman. He makes a good appearance, but he has clearly changed his story. So the prosecutor's like, 20 days after the murder, you told us this. And then a year later, the day after your girlfriend is arrested, you recanted. Isn't that true? And he's like, yes, essentially.
But they also asked him, he's like, but I did it because when I first talked to you, I was afraid. I've never been so afraid in my life.
I was under duress.
Exactly. I was under duress. And he said, did you tell the police officer? But you never said that. And he said, not to police officers.
Yeah. So,
and he said, but I was afraid. I was afraid for my life. And he said, but again, you never told anyone that.
It was pretty obvious that he was simply like trying to recant to help his girlfriend. So the prosecutor also plays a message that was recorded while she was in the jail and before trial started.
It was painfully obvious.
It was painfully obvious. They knew it was being recorded. There's a warning when you're, you know, well, at least in LA County, there's a warning.
It was for you.
It's going to be, your conversations are going to be recorded. And so the two of them are talking about how, you know, I was under duress when I made that original statement. Right. I've never been so scared in my life. And it was a very,
it rang false,
transparent
effort.
Exactly. And again, I say Rusty made a good witness. It seems to me that he changed his story, but he believed what he was saying. He had convinced himself that recanting was the right thing because there were so many conversations they had. There were so many text messages they had.
And there were thousands of them.
They literally had 3,200 text messages within 6 months.
They were like 12-year-olds.
They totally were.
It was crazy. Kathy and I were getting annoying just hearing about the calls.
Exactly.
We were getting annoying. We are annoying. Kathy and I were getting annoyed just hearing about the calls and texts and all that.
And so Rusty admitted on the stand, you know, that he loved Melody and that they were looking at wedding rings and all this kind of stuff. Another person who took the stand at trial was Cousin Martha. And the purpose of bringing Cousin Martha to the stand was to explain where the murder weapon could have come from.
Right. Because as we said, they never found the murder weapon.
Exactly. And so Cousin Martha, and I want Kathy to talk about Cousin Martha because she loved Cousin Martha.
I love Cousin Martha. She's just the cutest little person. She was in her 80s, I'm assuming, just based on how she looked. Would you assume that?
Late 70s, 80s.
You never ask a woman her age. Let's put her at 40. But she was Melody's cousin.
This is the one whose stepson was Rusty. So Martha takes the stand to say that in 2014, her husband died. But before he died, he bought her a gun to protect herself, and it was a .38 caliber revolver. And so that is the same caliber with which Gary was killed.
And they never found the gun.
Exactly. And Martha did not realize that her gun was missing until 2019, which was the same year that Melody was arrested. And so she calls like in the middle of the trial to say, I think I might be a witness. I think I might have owned the murder weapon.
Yeah, like a couple days in.
Exactly.
So she calls and she meets with the prosecution and they were just catering to this very lovely Southern lady. They were all calling her Miss Martha. And the prosecutor starts with, Miss Martha, we met for the first time yesterday, did we not? Yes, we did. I was nice to you, right? Yes, you were.
Yes,
I mean,
were.
It was just...
Was I polite?
Exactly. It was like, oh, just the sweetest thing.
I know.
But she goes on to tell the story about what had happened. And she called her niece and said, I think I had a missing gun. And the niece said, search high to low. And she didn't find it. And so the niece came over to actually help her look. And they still didn't find it. So Kathy needs to tell this part. So they were starting to show exhibit photos.
Oh, yeah.
This is awesome.
That's right. So it turns out, again, like Kathy said, Miss Martha just met the prosecutor the day before. So she's like, this is all in the middle of the trial. And so Miss Martha had taken a bunch of photos of her house just so the prosecutor could understand, this is where I used to keep my gun. This is where I used to, blah, 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 blah.
Here's where I looked.
Yeah, and here's a picture of my gun safe. And here's a picture of my extra bedroom and all this kind of stuff. So he's going through the exhibits. Can you look at exhibit 9? What is this? Blah, blah, blah. They hit exhibit 11 and she goes, oh no. And she closes her eyes.
And turns her head.
And turns her head away and she will not look at exhibit 11. And he was like, Miss Martha, can you just please tell the jury what exhibit 11 is? And she will not take her hands away from her eyes.
I can't possibly look at that.
I can't possibly look at that.
I didn't know that you were going to show that, especially so close up.
I know. That's what she
and
said.
And we're both dying. Like what is it showing?
Yeah. And she goes, that's my junk room.
Yeah. I had to get rid of some things after my husband died and I didn't know what to do with them. So I just put them in there.
So it was so funny. So the prosecutor's like, okay, let's go to exhibit 12. And then she like took her hands away from her eyes.
And would look again.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I'm not sure how much evidentiary
value.
There you go. There's the word that she provided, but she was awesome. Now let's get to the meat of the trial.
Exactly. So the prosecution called DNA experts, as a jury always expects these days, and they testified that Gary's DNA was a match to the blood drops on the kitchen floor and down the carpeted staircase.
Into the basement.
Into the basement.
The terrace level.
Exactly. The beautiful basement. They also said, because this was an issue in the trial, like how would somebody so small, because what was
Melody was 5'2" and 130 pounds, and Gary was 6'4" and 320 and literally dead weight.
Exactly.
And they're like, there's no way. They even did a demonstration. Do you remember that? They packed like potato sacks. I don't know what they put in there. But
I think
like
rocks. This was in closing argument.
Oh, was it closing argument?
It was closing argument.
And they packed it. And so then the attorney, who's probably like a $1.65 soaking wet, like he wasn't a large man anyway.
I could have kicked his ass.
I feel like it was like the OJ moment where he was playing to the camera. I totally felt like he was.
But that was a good demonstration.
It was. It totally
was. The whole
was.
Point was, how did she move these bodies? And so the prosecution theorized she could have used the RTV or she could have used this little tractor. And it was like a mini tractor. It was actually really cute. It wasn't like this big, huge, ginormous tractor.
Right.
But it was a tractor with like a, what do you call it? Like a scoop.
A bucket.
Thank you.
So I like the hand movements.
So they did DNA on the tractor and they found Gary's blood on the tractor.
But not in the bucket.
It was located sort of above the driver's side rear wheel well, I want to say. Anyway, so then with respect to the RTV, they found Melody's DNA on the shift.
Right, the gear shift.
But none of Gary's. So they're like, this is interesting. I mean, the fact that his DNA was not in the rear bed of the RTV or the bucket of the tractor.
Right.
Did kind of hinder the prosecution's theory.
I mean, if he'd been shot, and again, here's the thing, based on the bullet found in the rib bone, they said cause of death was from a bullet. But because there were no organs, no appendages, nothing, they actually couldn't tell with any certainty. But the assumption is if it was a bullet, there would be blood somewhere.
Died from a bullet wound. They also found Gary's blood on a shirt owned by Melody, as well as a pair of shoes. But they lived together. And what was their testimony about? There was testimony from Amanda, the daughter, that Gary had been bitten by a dog on his leg and that she had seen the bite marks. So that was the defense's way of explaining the blood. And last but not least, the .38 caliber, the spent bullet, and it wasn't a bullet casing. Kathy had to look this up because I was like, was it a bullet casing or was it a bullet? But it was a bullet that had been spent.
Right, because revolvers don't eject the bullet casing.
So the used bullet that was on the floor of Gary's suite had his DNA on it, but it was not blood related. Probably the most critical piece of information, the least explicable for the defense, was the testimony regarding geofencing and digital evidence. Geofencing means, as a detective, you can issue subpoenas and you could say to Google, you basically circle a geographic area on a map and say, I want to know all the cell tower and when they did it and all this kind of stuff.
That's how they got the Gilgo Beach killer.
That's exactly right. Yeah. The Gilgo Beach killer in New York. And so they also can take a specific number and say, did this phone number hit this cell tower? Super sophisticated, takes a long time to get the information. They produce an expert witness who takes a stand at trial. Leading up to this expert witness, they talk about July 2nd. July 2nd was a pivotal day. That's the day that Scott testified to hearing his mother say, I can't wait till he's dead. I can't wait till something like,
I don't have to deal with him anymore.
Something like that. And that was Melody talking about Scott's dad. July 2nd was the day that Melody threw his dinner plate at the door. There was a lot of tension happening on July 2nd. So anyway, this witness takes a stand. She is an expert and she's talking about who is where leading up to the point of the murder. The prosecution knew that on Tuesday night, July 3rd, Scott had gotten home late and he saw the burn pit with a glow. So they know that Gary's body has been placed on the burn pit on July 3rd. So a lot of the geofencing and digital evidence was focused on July 3rd and July 4th. Their expert witness basically says Scott was not home. It's confirmed that he left at about 6:30 in the morning and gets home at 11:30 at night. The digital evidence and the phone pinging, the geofencing also showed that Scott's phone left the farm at 6:30 in the morning on Wednesday, July 4th. Scott's gone all day. Gary's phone shows that on July 4th at about 6:30 in the morning, actually it's slightly after Scott left the property, Gary's phone is shown at the burn pit. Then at about 9 a.m., Gary's cell phone is shown moving from the house to the burn pit and back to the house. So the geofencing evidence essentially says the only person who was home at the time Gary's phone was moving from the home to the burn pit, you know, back and forth, was Melody. There is no one else home because they know that the night before the fire was going because Scott saw it. At the time the defense presented their case, Melody did not take the stand. She exercised her Fifth Amendment right and stayed away from it. Again, the attorneys focused on how possibly could a 5'2", 130-pound woman, same, get this behemoth of a man, as you called it, to the burn pit. There was really no adequate explanation presented by the prosecution. The jury is sent into deliberations after, like, I don't even know, 5 weeks of trial or something like that.
It was 18 days. So yeah, 4 weeks, 5 weeks. Yeah.
So they're sent into deliberation. After 3 days, they come out and they tell the judge, we are hopelessly deadlocked. We absolutely cannot make a decision in this case. And he's like, I understand. Get your butts back in that jury room. So the judge sends them back into the jury room. And 3 hours later, they come out with a unanimous verdict. Melody Ferris is guilty on all four counts. Fast forward to the sentencing hearing. And this sentencing hearing got major, major press. Everybody who was delivering information about it was like, you could not believe the sentencing hearing. So I'm going to read directly from some of the stuff that Melody said at the sentencing hearing. Victim impact statements count. And so, of course, the family members did provide statements. And I believe the prosecutor read one of the family member statements. Anyway, at a sentencing hearing, the defendant is allowed to put on evidence or give her own statement to give the judge an idea of what the overall picture of her life looked like. And the goal is to plead for some leniency. So Melody Ferris goes to speak, and this is some of what she says. I didn't take everything, but she started with this. She said, 6+ years of saying, don't talk. I've waited 6 years to make this statement to everyone. I want the world to know who did this. Not only did I not do this, I know who did. I know that Scott killed his father. He took Big Daddy from our grandchildren. Scott, this is unforgivable. I have spent an entire life of loving and protecting you, but this I refuse to cover. Now imagine everybody's in court. So the camera is on her and she's not turning around to address her son who is in the gallery. Cameras are on him and he's just like, he looks like it was like a combination of anger and disgust and surprise. And then she addresses Scott again without turning around in open court, but she's addressing him and she says, I saw you coming from the burn pile. You said you were checking on the extra wood. Where is Dad? You said that there was a gun missing from the basement that nobody knew about. She's picking up bits and pieces. She references the fact that he deleted pictures from the deer camera. Where are those pictures? When in fact, the digital experts were able to recover the pictures that were deleted from the deer camera and they showed nothing incriminating. At some point, the judge stops because the prosecution now, you know, they're objecting. They're like, they're hopping up and down.
There you go.
Hopping up and down. So the judge says, this is me paraphrasing, knock it off, Melody.
Zip it, old lady.
Yeah, he says, don't introduce new facts. Like, you had an opportunity to testify. And in the statement, she had said, I didn't take the stand. I listened to my attorney's advice. Okay, so she's trying to justify. And the judge basically says, look, this isn't what you're supposed to do during the sentencing hearing. If you wanted this admitted, you should have done it during trial. But she just continued. Eventually, the judge is like, you have to stop. If you don't stop, I'm going to let the prosecution cross-examine you and all this kind of stuff. And this is the part that's relevant that he would have allowed anyway. She says, I am begging you, Judge Cannon, please don't send me to prison for something I didn't do. A mother does not blame her child unless she knows he did it. You have no idea how heart-wrenching this is. And then she pretty much ends her statement by saying, as bad as it sounds, I want to be there to see him chained and shackled. The discomfort
of
everyone, anger / surprise / disgust was so palpable when she was making these statements
from everyone.
And the camera is like panning from this son to that son, back to Melody,
to the judge,
to the prosecutor. You know, it was not a victim statement that you would expect.
And did it work for her?
It did not work for her. Melody Ferris was sentenced to 30 years for the murder, 5 years for the aggravated assault, but they're going to run concurrently.
She was sentenced to a minimum of 30 years.
Yeah. So basically the judge said, you're getting life plus 5 with the possibility of parole. In Georgia, life means that you have to serve at least 30 years before the parole board can consider letting you go. And he also ordered her not to make any communication to any of her family members unless they wanted it. the family members were to reach out to the Department of Corrections and let them know, essentially, can she call me?
So Melody Harris, at this point, is eligible for parole in 2054, at which time she would be 94 years old. Thank you for listening. Thank you for watching. Let us know any cases you might have for us.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And hopefully next week I won't sound like this.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.